The blockbuster series of films based on J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter novels continues with Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, Part 1. It's based on the first half of Rowling's seventh and final Harry Potter book. The three young heroes are no longer at Hogwarts School for Wizards, and the dark wizard Voldemort is eliminating his enemies. And, of course, Harry is at the top of the list. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
There's nothing wrong with the 2.5-hour Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 1 that couldn't be solved if this weren't, in fact, Part 1. If the saga ended here, instead of stopping at the climax and saying, in effect, see you in 2011, suckers. But 2 years ago, Warner Brothers got antsy about losing its so-called tentpoles, multi-part properties that prop up the studio, and decided to split J.K. Rowling's seventh and last book into two films. I'm surprised they didn't split the second part in two, and the second part of that in two, and on into infinity. The movie has no satisfying finish, but to be fair, it has no satisfying beginning either. Wander in without having seen another Potter film, and you won't have the faintest idea what's going on. I needed a refresher course in Horcruxes. The Harry Potter wiki site says they're objects, quote, in which a dark wizard or witch has hidden a fragment of his or her soul for the purpose of attaining immortality. You need to know that, since the whole movie is the dark wizard Voldemort's nasty hordes chasing Harry and his friends Hermione and Ron as they try to find and destroy various Horcruxes. The first hour of Deathly Hallows is virtually a video game, and it's deadly all right. Voldemort's followers have taken over Hogwarts School and the Ministry of Magic and are on the hunt for Harry. Director David Yates does a poor job on the opening action sequence, in which Harry's friends and allies transform themselves into Harry lookalikes to confuse the onrushing villains. It's a funny scene when they all get Harry-fied. But Yates stays with the real Harry during the aerial chase, missing the obvious sight gag of bad guys thrown into confusion by so many bespectacled young men of small stature. Then Harry and friends sneak into the ministry to steal one of several Horcruxes, and the sequence is so badly staged and goes on for so long, the filmmakers appear to be filling out the running time. The surprise is how much better the second part of Part 1 is, when the action stops dead. Harry, Hermione, and Ron go on the lam and drift around the English countryside, across barren landscapes under low gray skies, getting on one another's nerves. In an invisible tent they've erected, Rupert Grint's Ron finally breaks and attacks Daniel Radcliffe's Harry and Emma Watson's Hermione.
What's wrong?
Wrong? Nothing's wrong. Not according to you, anyway.
Look, if you've got something to say, don't be shy. Spit it out.
All right, I'll spit it out. But don't expect me to be grateful just because now there's another damn thing we've got to find.
I thought you knew what you signed up for.
Yeah, I thought I did too.
Well, I'm sorry, but I don't quite understand. What part of this isn't living up to your expectations? But did you think we were going to be staying in a 5-star hotel, finding a Horcrux every other day? You thought you'd be back with your mum by Christmas?
I just thought, after all this time, we would have actually achieved something. I thought you knew what you were doing. I thought Dumbledore would have told you something worthwhile. I thought you had a plan.
I told you everything Dumbledore told me. And in case you haven't noticed, we have found a Horcrux already.
Yeah, and we're about as close to getting rid of it as we are to finding the rest of them, aren't we?
Ron, please take the Horcrux. You wouldn't be saying any of this if you hadn't been wearing it all day.
Do you know why I listen to that radio every night, dear? To make sure I don't hear Ginny's name. Or Fred. Or George. Or Mum.
What, you think I'm not listening too? You think I don't know how this feels?
No, you don't know how it feels! Your parents are dead! You have no family!
Stop! Stop!
Finally, go! Go then!
That's excellent psychodrama, and it's a vivid reminder that with all the enchanted kingdom imagery of Rowling's first books, her real subject is deadly serious. In common with her fellow Brits Tolkien and Orwell, Rowling is haunted by harbingers of fascism, in this case, race-based fascism. Voldemort's allies are purebloods, obsessed with rooting out muggles and mongrel mudbloods. The film's feel is paranoid, post-apocalyptic, and it's no wonder the central trio's well of affectionate banter has run dry. The rest of the actors are practically extras. It's like a Royal Shakespeare Company Halloween party. Helena Bonham Carter shakes her fright wig. Brendan Gleeson models his eye patch. Alan Rickman has a line or two. Michael Gambon, John Hurt. On one level, it's a waste. On another, hail to Warners for subsidizing their low-paying stage work. The series is a British actor tentpole, too. Rafe finds his Voldemort provides the scares. He looks like a flesh reptile and declaims like Captain Hook if the crocodile had bitten off his nose instead of his hand. I sure hope he gets a good send-off in Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2. Or who knows, Warners might order up a so-called reboot and do it all again.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hirschfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from EBSCO, supporting libraries with electronic resource discovery and management solutions, journal subscriptions, and EBSCO host databases. From Plowshares Fund, dedicated to helping build a safe, secure, and nuclear weapon-free world at plowshares.org. And from Subaru, where all vehicles are built in zero landfill plants. Love. It's what makes a Subaru a Subaru. This is NPR.
In 1962, Carlos Air was one of thousands of children airlifted out of Cuba, sent to Florida to escape Castro's regime. His parents thought he'd be back as soon as Castro was deposed.
In every Cuban's mind is the thought, this cannot last so long. So you gamble.
But he never returned home. On the next Fresh Air, Carlos Air. He has a new memoir. Join us.